Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Do we live on a privileged planet? I'm Robert Crowther at the Center for Science and Culture, and today we have a short clip about the book, The Privileged Planet. In the book, authors Guillermo Gonzalez and Jay Richards suggest Earth was designed for scientific discovery. They introduce a new idea, more than just that the Earth is a rarity in the universe. They argue that Earth is ideal for scientific observation. Specifically, they critique the Copernican principle, which holds that Earth is not special in its ability to support life. In this clip, Jay Richards lays out the problems with the Copernican principle.
The Copernican principle, we think, expresses in astronomy and cosmology what some folks in biology call methodological naturalism in biology. So there's a way in which metaphysical assumptions can work their way into various scientific disciplines. And those assumptions, they act differently in different fields, obviously. Well, if you're wondering how could, say, a metaphysical view of materialism or naturalism express itself in astronomy, we would argue that it's in the form of this so-called Copernican principle, which is expressed very sort of generically here by Steven Weinberg in a famous quote that you see. And this is sort of the opposite of the quote that Albert Einstein made that's in the documentary. But Weinberg, in a description of cosmology in a popular book, says, "The more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it also seems pointless." And Weinberg is expressing this general idea of the Copernican principle, which is narrowly construed, just says that the Earth or Earth's inhabitants hold no special or privileged position in the universe. And that has, you know, kind of vague or ambiguous metaphysical implications, but it usually walks hand in hand with what we call this metaphysical Copernican principle, which is just something like this. We're not here for a purpose, and the cosmos isn't arranged with us in mind. Our astronomical location is as insignificant as our metaphysical status. Now, you won't see these various types of the Copernican principle sort of delineated this way, but I'm doing this because I want you to see here, and I hope I can persuade you in just a few minutes, that the Copernican principle has virtually nothing to do with the Copernican Revolution. In fact, it's a sort of, we think, a 19th or early 20th century gloss on the Copernican principle, which is essentially a kind of revising of the history of science to make the history of science more amenable to a sort of grand materialistic narrative. Well, let me just give you an example of what we call the Copernican stereotype. This is the stereotype about what Copernicus did in 1543 when he wrote his book on the revolutions of the heavenly spheres. This is a quote from retired Microsoft founder Nathan Myhrvold, written in Slate magazine and then Time magazine in 1996. And this is a story that was written after the discovery of the Martian meteorite in Antarctica, which initially suggested to some people that it had evidence of ancient microscopic life in it. And this is how Myhrvold describes the history of cosmology and astronomy. It says, "Ptolemy, 2nd century, was the first and boldest in a long succession of spin doctors for the primacy of human beings. The whole universe, he postulated, rotated around us, with the Earth sitting at the center of heaven itself. Now, any marketing consultant will tell you that positioning is everything, and center of the universe is hard to beat. A Polish astronomer named Copernicus rudely pointed out, 'Sorry, Earthlings, we spin around the sun, not vice versa.' Giordano Bruno, a sort of 16th century Carl Sagan, popularized these concepts, saying, among other things, that innumerable suns exist, innumerable Earths revolve around those suns, living beings inhabit these worlds. Bruno's crime, like Galileo's, was to undermine the uniqueness of our planet, and by doing so, to threaten the intellectual security of the religious dictatorships of his time. Over time, advances in astronomy have relentlessly reinforced the utter insignificance of Earth on a celestial scale." So you get the idea. Myhrvold is saying that prior to Copernicus, we thought that we were in sort of the throne room of the universe. We enjoyed pride of place in the center of the universe. And what Copernicus said is, well, no, in fact, we rotate around the sun. We're insignificant. We're not where we thought we were. We're not in the throne room of the universe. And in fact, what Copernicus did is he started a trend that science has continued up to the present time of showing us just how insignificant we are. That's the idea of the Copernican stereotype. And most of you, if you've ever had an introductory astronomy textbook read to you or have had an astronomy course in which the Copernican Revolution was described, will probably have heard something like that. The problem is that every historian of science knows this is nonsense. Almost everything about the description of the Copernican Revolution here is simply wrong. So that's sort of the main problem. But the problem is that astronomy textbook writers don't normally read historians of science, and so the word is not out yet. And I think I can show you the problem in about 5 minutes, okay? So I sort of stated that strongly. But let's think about it here for a minute, okay? Now, the first part of the explanation is to understand what the pre-Copernican cosmology was like. What did Europeans think prior to 1543 about what the universe was like? Well, this is a diagram of what we call the Aristotelian or Ptolemaic cosmos, which is really a combination of the observations of Ptolemy and the sort of physics and cosmology of the Greek philosopher Aristotle. And as you can see, the basic description of the sort of, you know, the geography is the same as Myhrvold has it. You've got Earth in the immovable center, and then you have these spheres, and they were sort of imagined generally, if perhaps poetically, as these glass or crystalline spheres that rotated with the planets attached to them. And then the planets rotated on other little circles called epicycles, which I'll explain in a minute. And these spheres rotated around the Earth, and the outer sphere, the celestial sphere, had the stars attached to it. And then God inhabited an outer outlying sphere called the Empyrean sphere. Okay. Now, Ptolemy suggested, and it was maintained in this cosmology, that the planets were on these sort of little whirlwheels here, like a, if you think about it as sort of an amusement park ride that goes in a circle, and then on the circles you have little circles themselves. Okay, those are called epicycles. And the reason for this is because, assuming that the Earth is at the immovable center and the planets and the sun and the moon are moving, you know, around us, what happens if you track the course of the planets across the sky? At certain times, they'll be moving in one direction, and then they seem to move backwards. And so to account for this, in the sort of pre-Copernican cosmology, you had these little epicycles. And so this is sort of the basic idea. All right. So that much, of course, of the pre-Copernican cosmology is right. The Earth's in the immovable center, and this, other things revolve around it. Now, this is the sort of Christianized version of the Aristotelian or Ptolemaic cosmology. And it was Christianized, really, in the Middle Ages, and you can see it as most richly described in Dante's Divine Comedy, in which he takes the reader really on a journey through the cosmos from the Earth. And so here we've got the description. I guess you can see this. These are basically the various celestial spheres, with the lower sphere of the moon and then the planets and the fixed stars, and then the sort of unmoved mover of everything else, which is God outside the structure as a whole. But you notice also the Earth. And if you read Dante's Divine Comedy, you'll discover that as there are these celestial spheres above the Earth, there are also these earthly spheres that mirror those spheres, going from the surface of the Earth to the center of the Earth. And if any of you have read the Purgatory and the Inferno, you'll remember this, because this is a description of the reader being taken essentially on a tour to hell. And what you discover when you get to the very center of the Earth is Satan's throne, and Satan is frozen solid in the very center of the Earth. Now, that already should tell you that something was up, right? Because remember, we were told that in the pre-Copernican cosmology, the center of the universe was the best place to be, and that to be removed from the center of the universe was a put-down, right? Now, that's the opening story in the narrative of the materialist march of science from its early beginnings. But we already see that there's something wrong, because in the pre-Copernican cosmology, the center, the very center of the universe, is the center of the Earth. And the center of the Earth was Satan's throne, which isn't really the best place to be, right? Well, it also turns out that the Earth was not an especially special place as well. And anyone that knows Aristotelian physics knows that the Earth, the things below the moon, the sublunar regions, is the place where air, earth, water, and fire mix, and death and decay occur. So you have the mutable realm, especially on the surface of the Earth, where things die and decay. But the moon and above were made of a fifth element, the quintessence, which was immutable and perfect and eternal. So in other words, the center of the universe in the Aristotelian cosmology, the surface of the Earth and the very center of the universe, was not the best place to be. It was not the throne room of the universe. So the initial description of the pre-Copernican cosmology is wrong. It's in fact inverted. So surely what Copernicus did and understood himself to be doing cannot be that he thought he was removing us from the throne room of the universe. Well, it turns out that it's precisely what Copernicus did not believe. And Copernicus and Kepler and Galileo and those initial scientists who believed in the so-called heliocentric cosmology actually thought they were giving the Earth a promotion because they were removing it from this place at the center, which was really the bottom. It's the place where things fell. For Aristotle, the reason the Earth and heavy elements are at the center of the universe is because things tend to their natural place, and so the heavy stuff falls to the center. But it's really more accurately understood as the bottom of the universe. And so when it was removed from this Aristotelian center and became a planet like the other planets reflecting the light of the sun, this was understood to be a promotion. And if you remember Copernicus and Galileo and these guys, they were humanists. They were Renaissance humanists. And so the last thing they're going to understand themselves to be doing would be to demote the status of human beings. And you can multiply these quotes without end. If you don't believe me, get Dennis Danielson's book, The Book of the Cosmos, which has representative essays from the founders of modern cosmology, and you can see this. And this is just a representative quote from Galileo himself, who, of course, was about a century after Copernicus. But here's how he describes his affirmation of Copernicus's cosmology. He says, "Many arguments will be provided to demonstrate a very strong reflection of the sun's light from the earth. This for the benefit of those who assert, principally on the grounds that it has neither motion nor light, that the earth must be excluded from the dance of the stars. For I will prove that the earth does have motion, that it surpasses the moon in brightness, and that it is not the sump where the universe's filth and ephemera collect." That was the pre-Copernican understanding of the Earth. It was the cosmic sump. So whatever Copernicus did, he certainly did not understand himself to be removing us from the most important place in the universe. Now, that's important because I think it at least dispatches this idea that what Copernicus did is he started a trend, and the trend was that natural science shows us we're insignificant in the universe. Now, the sort of logical fallacy that's made here is that if a universe is geocentric, that is, if the Earth is in the center of someone's cosmology, that means that you're also anthropocentric. That is, if the Earth's in the center, that means humans must be in the center. But as you can see, it doesn't follow. A cosmology could be geocentric and have Earth in the immovable center, but human beings could still be occupying at best an intermediate place on the surface of the earth, where they can either die and decay like the earth or can die and ascend to the heavens as spiritual beings. And that was actually the medieval understanding. We're in an intermediate place. So this is a fundamental logical fallacy that a geocentric cosmology requires that a cosmology be anthropocentric. And so that's basically the false assumption. There's also a non sequitur. There's something that simply doesn't follow, and it's this. It's the idea that since we're not centrally located, that our location, therefore, in time and place, and moreover, our status, are insignificant. It simply doesn't follow. These are two different issues. Whether we're in the center of the universe, we're around a sun, or we're around a single star in a very large galaxy, that's a separate question of whether intelligent beings like ourselves or habitable planets are insignificant or unintended. They're simply separate questions. So we felt in the book like we had to dispose of this historical myth in order to deal with the issue at hand. And we think this is really the question. Once we've dispensed with the nonsense about geocentrism entailing our importance or unimportance, and it's just this. Is the Earth really an insignificant speck in an impersonal universe? Do we really exist for no purpose? Or is the truth otherwise? And if it were otherwise, how would we tell? Is there something about the universe that would suggest that that's the case? That's the question.
As Richard just explained, you might have learned that Earth and its local environment provide a delicate and probably exceedingly rare cradle for complex life. But there's another, even more startling fact described in the book The Privileged Planet. Those same rare conditions that produce a habitable planet that allow for the existence of complex observers like ourselves also provide the best overall place for observing. What does this mean? At the least, it turns our view of the universe inside out. According to Richards and Gonzalez, the evidence we can uncover from our earthly home points to a universe that is designed for life and designed for discovery. For more information about the book and about the documentary film, The Privileged Planet, visit the website www.privilegedplanet.com. That's www.privilegedplanet.com. I'm Robert Crowther for IDTF at the CSC in Seattle. Thanks for listening.
Music on ID the Future comes courtesy of composer Yuri Mamchur. Visit www.yuriproductions.com and check out his latest CD, In the Harbor. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery President is Bruce Chapman. ID the Future Managing Editor is Robert Crowther. And the producer is Keith Bennett. ID the Future and ID Science in the News is copyright Discovery Institute 2006. For more information, visit www.discovery.org or www.idthefuture.com.